This is BBC Radio 4. Well, as you may have just heard in the news, the great Alan Corran, pillar of the news quiz, passed away during the night. His family has asked for this week's news quiz, recorded before the team knew of his death, to be broadcast as usual.
We present the news quiz with your host, Sandy Toksvig.
Hello and welcome to the news quiz. This week, the Director General announced that to deal with cutbacks at the BBC, there will have to be more repeats. So here's my quota. House prices are crashing, our schools are awful, Diana's still dead, and for God's sake, don't go near an NHS hospital. Right, let's get on with the show. We start with a report from the BBC News website read by Corrie Caulfield.
The Conservative Party has lost a court battle to keep an £8.3 million bequest by a man whose son described him as delusional. Handing down his judgment, Mr. Justice Henderson said Branislav Kostic would not have left the money to the Tories if he'd been of sound mind.
And our thanks to absolutely everyone for sending that in. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first on my right, Francis Ween and Mark Steele. And opposite them on my left, Andy Hamilton and Justin Edwards. Francis, who was mercilessly removed from power this week?
Well, I think you have a lot to answer for, Sandy, actually, because poor old Min Campbell has fallen victim to the curse of Toksvig. Sandy the merciless, because about a month ago, you two were seen on television. You were seen kissing Ming on telly.
And his wife was watching.
And now he's gone. You gave us a kiss as we came on stage today, so I think we'll be first for the chop when the Mark Thompson terror kicks in. But anyway, he's gone. He said he'd had enough. He was fed up of people going on about his age and making out that he was Godfrey in Dad's army and that sort of thing. May I be excused? And so he's been excused. He's gone off to spend more time with his sister Dolly's fairy cakes. All these young thrusters, jostling to take over, called Chris and Nick and Steve and that sort of thing. Not Ming at all, you see. It's quite different. It's a new, modernised liberal.
So they're going to try and sound all young and stuff and come out and go, it's not like the Ming. He's old school blood, isn't he? You know. He's going to mash up the two-party system, you get me, you know. Labour Tory, always with a beef with the issues, you know. I love doing this to a Radio 4 audience. It makes me feel so young.
He's not old, though, is he? He is 66. I mean, Gladstone, the greatest Liberal Prime Minister of all time, he was 83 when he started his last term of office.
And I still looking for prostitutes at that
age. Yeah, I know he was, yeah. Just for their own good.
Yeah, he's only a year younger than Cliff Richard.
Yeah. Is he really? It doesn't sound so good when you say it like that.
What I should say is, can you believe that Cliff Richard is older by a year than Min Campbell?
I do hate this obsession with people's ages, though. I have sort of confidence that I should be replaced by a 16-year-old called Keeley. Do you not think? And then I thought, that's not a bad idea. We could have the News in Briefs quiz. Do you not think?
That's my favourite. Ben's version of the News quiz. Oh, like, we have so got some classic cuttings.
Yes, indeed, the resignation of Sir Ming Campbell. Irritated by the media's obsession with trivia and society's fixation on age, Sir Ming, 107, said he was disappointed at not being allowed to run in a general election. Every Lib Dem leader should have the chance to come third in at least one. 2 points to Francis. Mark, who's overworked, overproductive, and luckily over here?
Foreign people.
Foreign people. And 2 points to Mark Steele.
I'd say that's the case, yeah, because, of course, against the normal argument that is put forward, which is that, you see, immigrants come over here and it makes us worse off because it means that we've all got to share things out.
And well, they get to chair the news quiz and things like that, which...
Foreigners doing all those jobs the British don't want to do. You know, sweep the streets, pick vegetables, sleep with Prince Philip. I think it's fair enough.
I did have a taxi driver who complained saying, well, it's not right, I come over here, I can't speak the Queen, they got no skills and they're taking our jobs away. And you're saying, well, so you're saying that someone who can't speak your language and is less skilled than you is better than you at your job. It doesn't reflect well on him.
Did he ask you to get out of the cab then?
Yeah, actually, I more thought that than said it. I've got some convictions, but it was raining.
I got in an argument in a pub with a bloke a little while ago who said, I'll tell you what is with these Kosovans, right, is that they come over here and they undercut our decent British builders' bloody rates because they're prepared to work for less. That's what they do. I said, oh, I don't think that's true. He says, it bloody is, mate, because I own a building firm and I employ them.
It's a major government report, thank goodness, from the Migration Impact Forum, and it's concluded that immigrants are vital to the British economy, making up 12% of the working population and generating £6 billion a year. Apparently, immigrants work longer hours, take less sick leave, are more reliable. The report's authors gloomily predict that it's going to take years to drag them down to our standards. So, 2 points there to Mark. Justin, which epidemic spread could be of global proportions?
This will be fat people.
It is about fat people, yes.
Or obesity, and the government have said a quarter of all children, half all adults, will be clinically obese in the next 10 years or something like that. Not very good with numbers, but an epidemic on the scale of global warming and will cost the NHS £45 billion a day in diabetes and broken chairs and burst trouser accidents. The government did set a target saying we're going to halve the number of obese children by 2010. And then they said last week, actually, no, we're going to halve the number of obese children by 2020. We didn't realise just quite how fat the children are. And a sort of heart charity saying to the, well, the government have simply moved the goalposts. And I thought, well, that's encouraging, because if you do move the goalposts farther away, the fat children will simply have to run further. But as it turns out, the number of playing fields that have been sold off, they've actually had to move the goalposts further in. So all the fat children are just sitting in a pile eating trans fats, not trying.
I don't think you can talk about trans fats now. There was a new law about different kinds of sexuality, and I think trans fats
are into one of those, yeah. But it's no longer your fault. It's not the fault of the individual if you're obese. It's the fault of the society around us, because energy-rich foods and labour-saving devices and sedentary lifestyles have made us all fat. I agree with that. I'm a few pounds overweight, and it's... don't laugh. And it's not because I treat fudge and lager as food groups. It's because the world around me simply won't let me burn off the calories I should.
I think it's rather clever to say what we'll do is we're going to get rid of obese children by 2010, but we'll do it now by 2020, by which time they'll be adults.
I couldn't for the life of me see how this could be true, that Alan Johnson said that obese people are a bigger threat than global warming. I mean, unless they all get into the ocean at the same time, I can't see how that can be the case. I think they've looked ahead. I think they've worked out the real worry with obese people is if you look at most hospitals, they have revolving doors.
In the same week that Health Secretary Alan Johnson warned that obesity could become as big a problem as global warming, the government quietly gave itself another 10 years to meet its target of halting childhood obesity. The government's previous strategy of reducing obesity by allowing fat kids to be bullied at school had been judged a failure. Andy, how many EU leaders does it take to change a treaty?
Oh, well, this is... Well, I get confused. It's not really a treaty, is it? They're saying it's just a little bit of a tweak to the EU constitution, and we don't need to have a referendum. But anyway, it's over these red lines. Britain has got what... Under Margaret Thatcher, they were called opt-outs, but obviously New Labour decided that sounded a bit negative. So now we have opt-ins, and we're allowed to opt-in if we see fit. And everyone's saying we should have a referendum about it. I think 70% of people said we should have a referendum, but I'm not quite sure what we'd have a referendum over.
Well, now that you've explained it so succinctly,
yeah.
I think it should be a doddle for all of us.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah, yeah, I thought I'd cut through a lot of the chat. Be fair, it's a story about the European Union.
Yeah.
Presumably, before the show, our new Polish producer... He's very good, very good. And especially, he's only 11. It's amazing. Presumably, there was a drawing of straws, and they said, someone's got to have the EU story, and my name came out of the hat. You know, I did my best.
You didn't mention the treaty with Lithuania that's going to be all part of it.
Is that real?
Oh, I don't know.
You're cheapening my answer by making stuff up.
I'm guessing a general lack of interest here, really. Yes, European leaders are meeting in Lisbon this week to thrash out the final draft of the EU reform treaty. I get this wonderful picture of Alan Bates and Oliver Reed. And at the end of round one, the scores are Francis and Mark have got 4 points, but Andy and Justin are just in the lead with 5. Round time too with a cutting from The Observer regarding the current postal strikes.
Tomorrow, the union's executive will vote on whether to recommend the terms. If, as expected, it does, all further strike action will be suspended while postal workers are balloted on whether to accept the settlement. The union says the result of the postal ballot should be known in a month.
Thanks to everyone who spotted that. Francis, which world-beating win might not be honoured?
World-beating win? You don't mean the Rugby World Cup, do you?
I do.
England, against all expectations, have got through to the final, and they're playing against South Africa. There was a story saying Nelson Mandela was going to fly to Paris for the final, and then a story appeared saying he would be expected to swap shirts after the game with Prince Harry. And he was obviously so appalled at the idea that he'd have to put on one of Prince Harry's amusing Nazi fancy dresses that Nelson Mandela's office immediately cancelled the trip and said he wasn't well enough to travel.
But why might they not be honoured, Francis?
Well, Johnny Wilkinson may or may not get a knight to it, because there was a bit of a fiasco with the England cricket team winning the Ashes, and they were all given OBEs or something, and they haven't won a match since, so it's thought to be a bad thing, giving them all indiscriminate honours.
But it's perhaps something to do with the cash for peerages. They're a bit anxious now about giving out honours.
Well, that was how the High Court, when that poor man who left 8 million quid to the Conservative Party in his will, that's how they decided he was of unsound mind. It wasn't just that he was leaving, giving all this money to the Tories, it was that he didn't want a peerage in return. I mean, clearly he's doing that.
Linda Smith used to say that rugby was a game for men with no fear of head injuries and no reason to fear them.
I've been following it. There's this Phil Vickery. He has sellotape on his face to control his scrumpox.
Scrumpox. My brother's got it.
It's nasty stuff, scrumpox. Yeah. My brother had it.
What is it? It sounds like a cider alcopop.
It's what you get from being in the scrum. And my brother lost his sight for a while when he had scrumpox. It got very bad. He couldn't see for a while.
What I don't understand about it, because I mean, I love watching it, because I love watching sport, but what I don't understand is that in the middle of the game, the sort of ball's at the bottom somewhere, and there's 15 blokes, and they're all piled on top of each other, and another one comes on top and drags some of the others away and stamps on their head and elbows them in the face, and the commentator's going, oh, that's a good bit of work from the back. And then all of a sudden the ball bubbles out, and it's penalty, but all of that was legal, and then you think, well, what was the penalty? Nothing. Oh, that's incorrect use of a preposition. Position, the referee's getting a penalty. Well, I just don't understand it.
Now, the violence is sort of built in and legitimate, isn't it, in the game? I remember when I was at college, a friend of mine who played at quite a high level and played for England under 21s and stuff, and he sat down opposite me at breakfast. And the first thing I noticed, I mean, he had those, you know, the ears that looked like an adventure playground. but he also had a rather strange sort of thing on his nose. I said, oh, what happened there? And he said, oh, we played Gloucester. And as if that explained it. And I said, oh, what happened? He said, oh, I got bitten. But, you know, he didn't bat an eyelid. I said, you got bitten? He said, yeah, it's my own fault.
This is the news that if England win the Rugby World Cup, there is no guarantee that the squad will be recommended for the honours list because of changes following the cash for peerages scandal. ITV are going to show the match in full, Sky Sports will be showing highlights, and BBC One will show a repeat of Only Fools and Horses. Well, there's some truth in there somewhere. Andy, who has been pulling out all the stops to avoid going private?
Do you know, I've made it a point in my career never to do jokes about dentists. Because I thought, I never want to hear the sentence, I thought you were very funny on the news quiz this week. Open wide, please.
Looking into the eyes of Laurence Olivier.
Yeah. If you think of the power of dentists, the story is that it's becoming, nigh on impossible, apparently, to find an NHS dentist. People have been resorting to extracting their teeth the good old-fashioned way by tying bits of string to doorknobs. It's a scandal, and I don't think there's really much of an answer, except that presumably if all our teeth rot and fall out and we can't eat, that solves the obesity problem.
Well, it explains the level of binge drinking as well. You need to be in the hazardous wine-drinking region before you can pull your own teeth out with a plier, don't you?
Adventures with dentures. Depravities with cavities. But it's, I think they get a very raw deal, dentists, if you think about it. I mean, all these teledrama series set in hospitals with lots of doctors and things, you never ever see. Well, I've never seen a drama series about dentists. Or the only film I've ever seen about dentists was Marathon Man, and that wasn't much of an advert for their profession, was it? And I don't see why you can't have, say, Hugh Laurie in some groovy American TV drama playing the eccentric, quixotic dentist who gets to the bottom of the cavity when everyone else has failed. Then people would go into dentistry, and then perhaps there'd be more of them.
Francis is wrong. There has been a TV series about a dentist because I was the voice of a cartoon thing called Bob and Margaret. In fact, many years ago, after doing the news quiz, it was about 15 years ago, I was at home and the telephone rang and a voice said, "We're making a cartoon and we think that your voice would be the perfect fit for the lead character." I was a bit flattered and I said, "Oh, really? And what is the lead character?" And they said, "A menopausal dentist."
I had a dentist thing at the local dentist. It was this Polish woman, and she had the radio on in the corner, and it was one of them things where all like these big long pins had to go in. I had about 10 of these things. I don't know what they were doing, and then it gets to the point where you can't say anything, just noise, and that thing that goes under the tongue, all that. And then Phil Collins came on the radio, and it was just more horrible. And I was sort of grabbing her arm and went, "Oh, Collins! Oh, Collins! She was going, "Sorry, the pain won't be much more, Mr. Steele. You'll be good. It's not much, just a few minutes." "No, sure, I don't want that. I don't want a nerve being dragged out. That's all right. It's a clear cocking Collins."
More bites. There aren't very many dentist songs. I was 30 or more years ago, I was in a band called Hank Clinton and the Bijou Pervettes. It's true, I was Hank Clinton and the Bijou Pervettes were my backing singers, and our showstopper was this song I'd written, and the opening verse went, "You used to be my own true love. We went together like hand in glove. In the labour of love, we were only just apprenticed. Then you went and ran off with my dentist." And it was a great success.
Where? A survey out this week revealed that many people are avoiding dental treatment or even resorting to treating themselves due to a shortfall of NHS dentists. And some people have even resorted to pulling their own teeth out. You cannot imagine Radio 4 listeners doing that, can you? Unless they accidentally tune in to Quote Unquote. At the end of round two, Francis and Mark have got 8 points, and Andy and Justin are still in the lead with 9. Before we start round 3, here's a cutting from the Inverness Courier.
Inverness singer Enrica Ross is remaining positive about her future musical career, despite her girl group W4's rejection from the X Factor at the weekend. "We've got lots of meetings coming up," she said. "Keep your eyes open. We're not going anywhere."
And our thanks to Roger Niven for that. Mark, why should the Suits swear by swearing?
Oh, answer for me. Is this the BBC one?
It might be the BBC and every other workplace. It's swearing at the workplace is good for you.
Yeah, can I just stop you there? Because this is a whole question about swearing, and so I was a bit anxious because we wanted to go out. So I've drawn up alternative swear words that I'm entirely happy for you to use. And if you could put these in at any point where you felt a swear word would be necessary.
Okay. That's not very kind, actually. Mark Thompson at the head of the list.
No. Now, I've done a list of American
just
swear words.
Just between cockscomb and codpiece. Swearing in the workplace, if you swear at work, it helps you let off steam so you don't get all stressed. And it also raises corporate morale because everyone else can join in.
Apparently so.
That's why we're in such a mess at the BBC, because we don't have to swear on the
air. It works.
It sounds like a load of hemp seed to me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Extra point to Justin there.
I'll be quiet, you fustelarian. You've made these up, Sandy.
My favourite is flapdragon, which really sounds horrible, doesn't it?
I don't understand why wagtail is in there. That's just a bird, isn't it?
What about rabbit sucker? You're a naturalist, clearly.
Pigeon egg. What could that have been?
Which one?
So it says pigeon egg. People sort of like stub their toe and go, "Oh, pigeon egg!" Can't
it does work, that idea of letting off stress in the workplace, because I heard a brilliant example of it a couple of weeks back. I was on a district line train, and I was right at the end of the lead carriage, just behind the driver's cabin. The train came to a stop, and then it started doing that sort of lurching thing as the driver tried to start the train, and I could hear her through the cabin door, and she was an East End lady, and she was on the phone, so she was going, "Hello, control, this is train 417, I have lost traction, please advise," and I think control might have been a man, because she started saying, "Yeah, I've done that, yeah, and I've done that, yeah, I have lost traction, I can't, yeah, and I've done that," and there was a long pause, and I don't know what he suggested. But then she said, "Well, I could do that if I was a f***ing wizard." Now, there's a problem with that, because if the 11-year-old Polish producer decides to keep that in, they'll have to bleep the moment where I swore. And I always think the problem with bleeping is that the audience at home don't really know which swear word I used. I think what the BBC need is a system of different bleeps for different words. So if it goes doot doot, you know it was the F word. And if it goes doot doot, you know it was something else.
I tell you what's interesting about that story is that one of the things that annoyed me about the report is said that they've discovered that women swear more than could be traditionally expected. Patronising
The whole show is going to sound like the Clangers now.
I'm not letting Mark start on swearing.
Never sworn in my life.
Team studying management styles at the University of East Anglia have concluded... have concluded that swearing in the workplace is good for stress and morale, which means that technically Alistair Campbell was a motivational speaker. Andy, whose wedding was a blooming disaster?
I'm just looking at this list of swear words now.
Justin, do you know?
I think it's American.
Yes.
Someone had some flowers, and clearly the flowers were either dead or wrong.
You're scraping around for obscure stories about American wedding flowers, just so you don't have to ask a question about the big story of the week, that we're all going to be sacked.
Well, I was trying to say that for a surprise, and we have drinks later.
Why can't we have a question about the BBC?
Well, we can have a question about the BBC if you wish. I can say to you, who's likely to lose their job soon? Francis. Have you got
Corey.
A new mark?
Well, Corey. Corey Caulfield over there was in the newspapers this week. It said that this man who chairs the trust, it's in the papers, I think the news is out, said he told BBC presenters and people to shut up and stop complaining about the fact they're all about to be sacked. And it's not just Humphreys and Paxman. It said there's a letter signed by Charlotte Green, Brian Perkins and Corey Caulfield. And this man, Lyons, is taking the whole lot of them on. Charlotte and Corey and Brian Perkins.
That's fantastic. I'd love to see Corey on a picket line. And here is a list of scabs for this evening.
That Director General, Mark Thompson, when he made this announcement, he's got this silly stubble, and someone obviously once told him he looked like George Michael, and he believed them, and no one around him has the nerve to say, actually, you look like a bit of a Burke, you look like a door-to-door pubic hair salesman. Bloody well shaved it off. Have we been sacked yet?
I've never been troubled by a door-to-door pubic hair salesman. I get students trying to sell their paintings, but I don't know whether I'd be interested.
Do you know
that'd be quite a hard sell.
I don't know how much trouble we're in this evening, but anyway.
So is the news quiz going to be affected by these sackings then? Is you going to be doing it all on your own, Sandy? And here is the questions. The first one is to myself. Following that, I'll be reading the cuttings and then reading out the scores.
And before we bring you the final scores, the very last of it, shall I do the one about the flower thing? Oh, we're not going to bother with it.
Justin knew it, but you'd tell everybody else, yeah.
A New York bride is suing her florist for $400,000. That's about 750 quid. After claiming that her wedding flowers were the wrong colour and had ruined her day. According to the woman, Elena Glatt's mother-in-law, the rest of the day went without a hitch, which seems a shame. All that fuss over the flowers, and she didn't even get married. Before we reveal the final scores, which I frankly don't care about in the slightest at this point, let's hear the cuttings the teams have brought along. Francis.
Sandy, this is another wedding disaster. It's from BBC News website, which will be closed down shortly. A Cumbrian couple's wedding plans are all at sea after the prospective bride dumped her fiancé's work van and all his clothes into a harbour. Following a pub row, Emma Thomason of Whitehaven loaded her boyfriend's van with his belongings, then rolled it off a ramp at the town's marina. The argument started when Jason Wilson wanted to stay out with friends and Miss Thomason wanted to go home. She put every single last item of clothing I had in the back of the van, he said. All I was left with were the clothes I was wearing. I haven't told her yet that the wedding is off. I think she can put two and two together.
Mark.
John Amos sent this in from the Isha Living Within magazine. Reading Crown Court have heard how James Robin stole a bike to make sure that he wasn't late for a hearing at the magistrate's court. He was appearing on a burglary charge.
Justin.
Cutting from the Leicester Mercury sent in by Mrs. Valerie Joyce. A 43-year-old man was the worse for drink when he appeared before a judge at Leicester Crown Court. When asked to stand up at the dock, Brendan Marinan struggled to get up from a chair, saying, "I will if I can." He also shouted to a friend in the public gallery, "Is there any of that lager left?" Marinan was swaying in the dock as he pleaded guilty to robbing a doctor of dihydrocodone tablets on November the 5th last year. He then guffawed with laughter. Judge Simon Hammond said he was adjourning the case for pre-sentence and medical reports. Marinan told him, "You can do whatever you like." Judge Hammond warned him not to be intoxicated at the sentencing hearing on August the 3rd. Marinan said, "Okie dokie," several times and cackled with uncontrollable laughter. Judge Hammond told him, "You might not be laughing at the end of the day." Marinan was released on conditional bail as he staggered out, followed by three friends. One said, "I can't believe he got away with that."
Hamilton.
This is from Colin J. Brennan and it's from the Irish Times. Sergeant O'Riordan said that when Crowe was interviewed, he asked the Garda what evidence they had against him. They told him that he had been identified at the scene. Crowe replied, "That's bullshit. Nobody saw me. I had a balaclava and gloves."
Take a look at the final score. Andy and Justin have got 12 points, but Francis and Mark went into the lead with 13. Before we leave you, here's a cutting from the London Light, sent in by Chris Moore.
A ferry captain had to call police after 25 passengers got involved in a mass brawl over which team would win the premiership. Sussex police arrested four men after the captain of the Dieppe to New Haven ferry called to alert them that a fight had erupted on the liner among work colleagues who were on a team-building day out.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Francis Green, Mark Steele, Justin Edwards and Andy Hamilton. In the chair was Sandy Toxic. And the news was read by me, Corey Caulfield. The chair script was written by Lisa Clark, Simon Littlefield and Danielle Ward, with additional material by Stephen Carlin. The producer was Ed Morris.
Say I read the scores out back to front. Week I forget to do the scores. This week, thrilled with myself to have done them correctly. So when you hear it, Francis and Mark win, when in fact they lost. And I know hundreds of people will write in.
You're going to have to write
really upset.
Oh, you flap dragon.